Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And I'd like to ask you, how deep is your spirit? How deep does it run? Where'd it go? Let's hope it didn't run away from us, or it's not too deep. But maybe it should be. We're going to find out how deep we can take it in a book, a wonderful new book, written by an incredible author who I've had on the show before. And I'm so grateful that he wrote Deep Spirit, Cracking the Noetic Code. And our author and guest is Christian DeQuincy. Christian, welcome to Energy Stew.
Hi, Peter. It's good to be here. Looking forward to our conversation today.
Oh, I am too, because this is one of the richest books that I've read in such a long time, because you're a consciousness maven. You delve into the deep spirit of who we are and what we're about. And this is a novel, actually. And it made it much more pleasurable reading for a lot of people, and I'm sure for your own enjoyment, of putting together a story, a yarn, that actually really brings us into the depths of deep spirit that you want to convey. And how do you feel about it?
Well, before we started our recording, I had mentioned to you that the experience of writing this book was the most pleasurable of all the books that I've ever written. I would get up in the morning and go downstairs to the keyboard, looking forward to what was going to unfold that day.
Right. What would the dolphin Darwin do today?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And also the other wonderful characters in the book. Not all wonderful, because of course we have to have some bad guys.
And what are they? Bad guys to have the drama.
Right. And what are they going to do? Yeah. And it's so fascinating, because Darwin, the dolphin, becomes the philosopher. He becomes the conveyor of deeper truths via telepathic communication to our two protagonists in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what I like is that the one protagonist, Dara, is a true scientist. Mm-hmm. Based on reason and logic, and is really trying to do something quite deep. He's trying to receive communications in the universe, some intelligence. He wants to receive any kind of frequencies that have a pattern that you could say there's some intelligence behind it.
Yeah, he's a NASA scientist, specifically what's called an exobiologist, or in some phrases, a xenobiologist. So his mandate, his job, is to search the heavens for signs of intelligent life. And so that's just a little bit of background. And he notices these strange patterns as he's observing a very distant quasar. And that's how the book opens up.
Right. And then he learns that you can find intelligence elsewhere rather than through his instruments.
Well, yes, and that kind of circles back to the meaning of the title of the book, which is Deep Spirit. So he spent a career looking for signs of life and signs of intelligent life in particular, in the galaxy and in the heavens. And through, as the story unfolds, he meets up with an anthropologist called Maya Santos, who's studying interspecies communication at the University of Hawaii. And they meet up, and through his relationship with her, it begins to open up to him that perhaps, and as she points out to him, that perhaps the alien intelligence he's looking for is much closer to home than in the distant stars. And so then part of his education, as he begins to work with her main subject, which is a dolphin called Darwin, as he begins to interact with her and with the dolphin, he begins to realize that there are blind spots and limitations in his scientific education. And so he begins to open up to, first of all, quite unwillingly and with a lot of resistance to some shamanic experiences. And these experiences pull the rug out from underneath his addiction to reason and logic as the only way to have access to knowledge.
And you brought Maya in as a woman who's from an original indigenous culture.
Yes, yes. She straddles two worlds. She comes from her father. The backstory: her father was an accomplished shaman, and she had been trained in that tradition, but she's also trained in science as an anthropologist. So she's both a shaman, she has shamanistic knowledge and wisdom, as well as scientific knowledge. And so she integrates the two.
So it was actually too easy for Darwin to communicate with her, and it wasn't taking the story far enough. You needed to bring in some friction, which was Dara's background as a scientist,
right?
So that you could position the process of indigenous culture versus Western culture.
Right, and just to backtrack a little bit, the main motivation for me, besides just the sheer joy of creative writing, the main motivation for me to write this particular book was that I'm trained as a philosopher, and most of my other books are about philosophy, particularly philosophy of consciousness, philosophy of mind, and the relationship between consciousness and the physical universe. Some of those books, while well received, I've got some comments that they were a little bit too academic for some of my readers. And so I decided to write this book to write a book that would address the main issues in my other books, but in a much more accessible and engaging way. And that was the motivation for writing Deep Spirit. Now, as I said, that he was looking for signs of intelligence out in the heavens. And as the story unfolds, he begins to open up to the possibility that maybe what he's looking for with this alien intelligence is much closer to home. And so the book is now taking us through that. And first of all, we realize that obviously Darwin, this shamanic dolphin, has a high degree of intelligence, very likely and apparently superior even to the intelligence of this scientist. And behind that, and this I'm fast-forwarding now to much later on in the story, he comes to realize that when it's suggested to him that the intelligence may be much closer to home than he thinks, there's a double entendre there, because actually what's been communicated is that his own way of thinking is blocking him from being aware of his own deeper intelligence embedded in the flesh of his own body.
Right, there's an alien inside of him.
Exactly, that each of us have our own, particularly in his case, trained as a logician, as a rational scientist, his access to his own intuition, and we all have access to intuition, although some of us are trained to ignore it or block it out, and he was one of those. And so he began to open up and realize that actually, at least in one aspect, the alien intelligence he's looking for is within him. It's his own intuitive capacities that are not confined just to his brain, but actually intuition is a whole body experience, a whole body process. And so it begins to open up to a very embodied experience of consciousness, which is something that previously had been alien to him.
Right, it's really about climbing into universal consciousness, and then we get beyond anything our Western minds can comprehend.
Yeah. The universal consciousness is the consciousness that's inherent in matter itself, in energy itself. That energy, unlike the energy, and this is something I cover in my academic books as well as in this story, that energy is not the energy that most physicists and most modern scientists think it is, which is dead and sentient stuff. And somehow or other, this dead and sentient stuff, through the process of evolution over millions of years, produces nervous systems and brains, and then somehow magically squirts out consciousness. That's the standard story in modern science. That is critiqued in my own work, and again in this novel, and particularly in the mouthpiece of Darwin the Dolphin, that consciousness is not something created by the brain. That consciousness exists in all matter, in all energy, intrinsic to energy. So energy actually has its own embedded awareness, has its own embedded wisdom, and is directing its own flow through evolution.
Okay, so we can call it consciousness. Another way to speak about it is intelligence.
Yes.
Because there's intelligence and consciousness. Form, to me, must be intelligent to have form. It has to find itself and hold itself. Otherwise, it would just fly off and nothing would have any shape of any sort. And so the whole universe has to know itself and have its own patterns of reality that are knowing. It's noetic science. But there's also self-consciousness.
Right.
And that's something that we get confused about, because I'm looking at my computer screen right now, looking at you, and I'm saying, well, okay, so is my computer screen itself conscious? Maybe, because it's a computer screen, it's doing its job, but it's not necessarily self-conscious. So where is self-conscious that we know it as a computer screen?
Okay, well, good. This is actually addressing one of the deeper philosophical issues that I cover in my work, and also present in this novel in a way that I hope is much more accessible and understandable. So in the general public, I've noticed over the years that when I talk about consciousness, a lot of people assume I'm talking about self-consciousness. And so it takes a conversation for me to indicate that actually, there's an important and valid and valuable distinction between consciousness and self-consciousness. Now, I would say, and I do say, that all matter has its own intrinsic consciousness. That the phrase I often use is that matter tingles with the spark of spirit. It's just naturally sentient.
Let's call it universal consciousness.
Well, it is universal because energy is universal and energy is intrinsically sentient.
But I mean that it's the consciousness that creates the form of the entire universe.
Consciousness is directing the flow of energy to create the material forms, the physical forms that exist in the universe.
Right.
However, I would point out that I'm not suggesting that this consciousness is something that acts on matter externally. It's not something outside matter that's shaping matter into form.
Right.
That consciousness is intrinsic, it's within matter itself. So it's matter energy guiding its own unfolding to produce what we understand as evolution. I think it's important for people to understand the distinction, as you introduced it, between consciousness and self-consciousness. And on my Facebook page called Consciousness for Life, I've posted an image, a graphic that I like, that I think illustrates that difference quite well. So if we picture consciousness as a line, as a straight line, with just the slightest curve. So at the left-hand side, the line is running parallel to the ground, but then gradually it's rising from the ground. And as it rises, the inclination, the angle symbolizes the degree of the evolution of consciousness. Now, as this line evolves, it's rising off the ground more and more and more, and eventually begins to curl around back on itself. Mm-hmm. This is the curve of consciousness that represents self-consciousness. It's consciousness evolving to the point of now becoming aware of itself.
Recognition.
That is self-consciousness. So self-consciousness is a form, is a subset of what we were earlier calling the universal consciousness. So whereas all matter has consciousness, very few forms of matter have what we would recognize or what we would call self-consciousness.
But then self-consciousness has to do with recognizing not only self, but the form that self takes and the form we live with that means something to us.
Yes, yes.
And it's the meaning that we create through our own self-awareness that we give labels to, that we identify as form and has recognition. Otherwise, we're just a pure state of consciousness that can't communicate with each other in the way we know communication. Mm-hmm. The way we know it, which is self-aware.
Yeah. So self-consciousness is consciousness aware of itself. I mean, it's almost tautological.
Right, but it creates awareness of life around us too.
It doesn't, because actually we have awareness of events around us even before we evolve to the state, to the level of self-consciousness. So for example, an amoeba going down to a single cell creature has amoebic consciousness, a very, very dim form of consciousness. It is aware of its surroundings. That's why it can find food and do whatever amoebas do within.
Right, but it doesn't know to call itself an amoeba.
Because it doesn't have self-consciousness, exactly. So it has awareness of its surroundings, but it is not aware that it is aware of its surroundings, which would require self-consciousness.
Right. And so it can all function through awareness of the reality that it itself knows. But somehow we have this greater reality, and it has its great limitations of what you talk about between thumb consciousness and flipper consciousness.
Okay, so now we're shifting to another major theme in the book, which is the difference between human intelligence and cetacean intelligence, the intelligence of whales and dolphins, for example, but it applies to other creatures. I think we could probably include octopus in that, as well as many other species that have high degrees of intelligence. The difference, one of the major differences between human intelligence, at least the application of human intelligence, and say dolphin intelligence, is that human intelligence is coupled with two other ingredients: an opposable thumb to manipulate the environment, and language to communicate ideas about how to manipulate the environment. Whereas whales and dolphins, also species with high degrees of intelligence, they evolved a different evolutionary strategy. Instead of like humans, whereas we evolved, not intentionally, but we evolved the opposable thumb, language and a high degree of intelligence, and that the combination of those three has enabled us to shape the environment to suit our needs and wants, at as we now know, at great cost to the environment that sustains us. The whales and the dolphins adopted a very different evolutionary strategy. Instead of adapting their environment to suit them, they evolved their form to be sleek and to be able to move through their environment without very much resistance at all. So their strategy was to adapt to their environment to almost a perfect degree, whereas we adapt to a different one where we want to change and manipulate the environment to suit us.
Well, it's a different way of thinking because of our unique human nature on detail and reason, that we can be much too superficial in reality versus even indigenous cultures, which have opposing thumbs, but they're more tuned to natural world. I'm also thinking of telepathic communication between all species within themselves and how they can create an amazing architecture and all kinds of form that other species can create in this world. And they don't have voices, they don't write on paper, but somehow they know how to signal each other and give commands and follow instructions quite succinctly.
Right. As we know, that many species, other species, have some form of language that's quite different from the symbolic language that we humans have developed. So, for example, bees communicate where to go to find distant flowers that have the best nectar and the best pollen.
Right.
So there are different ways to communicate, and one way of communication that I would say, and I won't go into the details of this now, but I would say that ultimately all communication begins or rests on the foundation of mind-to-mind sharing of meaning, which is technically called telepathy or ESP, extrasensory perception. So most communication and most perception is fundamentally non-sensory. Later on, when we evolve, when matter evolves to into the forms of species that now have physiological senses, now we can augment the extrasensory perception with sensory perception. Now, of course, because we've evolved always having our senses, and our civilization, our culture has indoctrinated us to assume that sensory perception is in fact the only real means of perception. But if we look into that in great detail, sensory perception requires extrasensory perception as its foundation.
Right. And science is fairly ignorant of that.
Well, yes. I mean, science is actually ignorant of anything to do with that. I don't mean that as a put down, because this is a strategy that science itself unwittingly adopted, you know, about 300 years ago, when particularly after Descartes introduced his form of mind matter or mind body dualism. And decided to focus, that science would focus on the matter side of that dualism and leave the mind, the spirit, the soul to the church to investigate.
Well, they had to, otherwise they would be killed.
There were political motivations for adopting that strategy.
Right.
But having done so, science then made a methodological decision that it was going to just from then on exclusively study the physical world, which it has done magnificently over the past few centuries. But along the way, it had a kind of an attack of amnesia. It forgot that it had restricted itself to studying the physical world. And when you do that, obviously all the results you get are results about physical processes. And then they erroneously concluded that since everything they were studying was physical, that's all that ever existed. And they'd forgotten that that's how they started out, and they started out by ignoring the mind and consciousness. And so they've relied on sensory empiricism, using the senses and technological extensions of those senses to study the world. And of course, you can never discover or study consciousness if you're just using the senses or technology, because consciousness is not amenable to that kind of perception.
So it's kind of interesting where artificial intelligence might be taking us with that limitation, and where we actually have more advantage, and people will say, no, we're going to be left in the dust to artificial intelligence. But there's a lot that I think they're leaving out as to the capabilities of humans.
Yeah, I think artificial intelligence is a misnomer. To have intelligence requires possessing consciousness. if you don't have consciousness as the foundation, there's not going to be any intelligence. And so computers and robots and all AI is really not artificial intelligence, it is simulated intelligence. What they're doing is using computer technology to simulate what these technicians and engineers and scientists assume are some of the basic characteristics of consciousness. And they model those into a computer through software and computer chips.
And missing the main point.
And they call that intelligence. Right. But in fact, the intelligence resides not in the robot, not in the machine, not in the computer. The intelligence resides in the consciousness of the designer who made those machines. The machines themselves are not intelligent. I mean, a good example of that is the Roomba vacuum cleaner that, you know, roams around apparently all on its own and picks up all the dirt from the floor. It's behaving intelligently. It won't go over a cliff if it comes to a stairway, for example. Right. So what most aficionados of AI, of artificial intelligence, don't realize is the difference between intelligent behavior, which is something we can observe and measure,
right,
and intelligence
and
itself,
consciousness,
which is consciousness, which is not measurable, which is not detectable.
Yeah. So we've actually run out of time, and there's so much more to talk about. Hopefully we can continue in another show sometime soon, because it's so wonderful talking with you. What website can you send people to?
Oh, if anyone is interested in the kind of work that I do and to see that, they could go to my website, which is christiandequincy.com. So it's my name.
Right.
And De Quincy is spelled DEQUINCEY.
Right. And this book is Deep Spirit, Cracking the Noetic Code. Christian, it's so incredible to talk with you. What fun. And I'm sure we'll have a great fun soon again, because I really want to get deeper into the deeper truths of your book.
Well, thanks. I've enjoyed it. And the time went by in the blink of an eye. So yes. And if you've got a lot of other questions and other topics you'd like
sure.
to explore, maybe we can schedule a part two. Or
great. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Sure. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver, heartriver.org. I'd love to hear from you, and thanks so much for listening. Mm-hmm.